Modernism in music, Alex Ross argues, is continuing to make waves even a century after it started. In his first book, The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century, he's provided a history of the composers and the music that made the century so different from the ones that preceded it. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased it has brought New Yorker music columnist Alex Ross to the show today. Hello.
Great to be here.
And we're just listening to a clip from Salome, and you begin your book with a performance of Richard Strauss's Salome in Graz. What was interesting about that particular performance?
Well, it was, first of all, the work itself was quite a revolutionary piece at the time, although now it's become quite popular and is on the repertory of opera houses everywhere. But it was shocking in its day, and there were chords, dissonances in this piece, which made everyone's hair stand up on end, and the lurid subject matter, Salome kissing the head of John the Baptist on the platter and so forth.
Well, it was based on the Wilde play.
Yeah, the Oscar Wilde play.
Which had already shocked audiences.
Yes, and he was very controversial, and it was quite a daring gesture for Strauss to take it on, and then he supplied this fabulously decadent score. But there was also this amazing audience for this one performance. It wasn't the premiere, that had happened a few months before, but for this Austrian premiere, Gustav Mahler, Strauss's friend and rival, was there with his wife Alma. Puccini came to see what his German rival was up to. Arnold Schoenberg, who was about to launch this harmonic revolution in Vienna, came with all his pupils. And the most remarkable fact was that the teenage 17-year-old Adolf Hitler may have been in the audience. He at least claimed he was many years later. And that's just a chilling mental picture to have of young Hitler somewhere in the back of the room with all these glittering musical celebrities up front. And you know, as a historian, I just couldn't help but grab this as a starting point for the book. It's all the major characters from the whole first part of the narrative all in one room.
Considering how conservative Hitler was about art in general, why do you think that he didn't feel that way about Strauss? In fact, Strauss became the equivalent of his commissar of music, didn't he?
Yeah, more or less for a couple of years before Strauss was a little too outspoken in some of his opinions and conspicuously carrying on his relationships with Jewish artists. But Hitler, he was very conservative, but he wasn't stupid about music, and he had a little bit of curiosity about what modern composers of a more conservative type were up to. And, you know, above all, he was just masterly at manipulating artists. So whether or not he actually liked Salome, we just don't know what his opinion of the piece was, he knew how to flatter a man of that stature by at least pretending to genuflect before him and to express this admiration. So, you know, and this, you know, in my book, the whole middle part of the story is very much concerned with the fate of artists in these types of regimes, and Stalin and Hitler as music lovers manipulating artists.
And then Richard Strauss becomes known to moviegoers as the guy who wrote the music for 2001.
Yes, of course. I mean, which is, you know, the score for that movie, the different pieces of music you hear in that soundtrack are an excellent introduction in a way to 20th century classical music, because you have the very familiar Alsosbach Zarathustra, but you also have these fantastically far out pieces by Ligeti from the latter part of the 20th century. So it's kind of the from these shining major triads, cosmic certainties in music, to the avant-garde sounds. It's a great little miniature portrait.
Well, a lot of avant-garde music appears in movies, and yet I think it's fair to say that classical music is still able to use your phrase, send ripples of unease through audiences, while modern art and literature don't do that anymore.
Yeah, I call it the Picasso problem, because you have you know, paintings by Picasso and Jackson Pollock and all the other daring modern painters selling for huge sums on the art market, $100 million or more. And, you know, no one questions the gigantic stature of James Joyce and Virginia Woolf and other authors who were quite controversial in their day. Whereas Schoenberg and his students, Berg and Webern, and many others still cause trouble for classical audiences.
And the New York Times still runs articles in the Sunday paper trying to figure out why that is 100 years after
right, yeah,
the
100
fact.
Years on, still trying to explain these mysterious phenomena. And yet, you know, as you say, these sounds are very familiar in other contexts. With Halloween coming up, it's a good time to reflect that no one ever making a horror movie or sci-fi thriller or any kind of other motion picture with a scary subtext could produce the characteristic moods and give a fright to audiences without recourse to Schoenbergian chords in the score. It's absolutely inevitable and expected in that context for the harmonies to get very thick and dissonant and far out. But when you put those same harmonies in the concert hall, still people grumble and cough and make their displeasure known.
When was Salome performed? When was that performance in Graz?
That was 1906.
So it's fairly early. What happened? That's before Rite of Spring and, in fact, before Schoenberg. What was the response finally, and what was the response when Salome was performed in the United States?
Well, it always caused a little bit of scandal. I think at those early performances in Germany and Austria, it was a pretty enthusiastic response from the audience. There were individuals who protested from one side or another, but basically everyone crazy for it.
In America, the
audience liked it, but a couple of very powerful people, J.P. Morgan's daughter, in fact, was quite scandalized, and after only one performance, it was taken out of the repertory of the Met and didn't return for a number of years.
Is that because sophisticated Europeans had already been kind of recognizes music moving in this direction? After all, they had Mahler, they had Scriabin, they had others who were pushing tonality to its farthest reaches.
A little bit of that, although with Salome, it was actually the subject matter which really caused the most trouble. So I think there was an element of prudishness in American culture at the time, which is still very much with us, of course, and that was what set people against Salome.
My guest is Alex Ross. His first book, surprisingly, considering how much he's written over the years, is The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. Franz Liszt wrote a piece called Bagatelle sans Tonalité in 1885. Did that make him the first composer of an atonal piece?
More or less. I mean, that's a debate you can have. There have been a little eruptions of dissonance throughout the 19th century, even before, and you have the beginning of Mozart's dissonant quartet, which seems to be really far away from any one tonality for a minute or two at the beginning. And Beethoven and Wagner, they're sort of brief explosions, a very intense dissonance.
They all understood that it could give something a real emotional impact.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, all of music, you know, through history, it was the sort of tug of war between consonants and dissonance, and these momentary dissonances are what give these pieces their deepest emotion and their undertow of you know, great issues being at stake and conflict and then resolution. So it was, dissonance is absolutely essential to the musical argument. What happens toward the end of the 19th century is there is more and more dissonance, and the tonalities become fewer, farther between. And Debussy, some of his pieces are really not tonal at all in the conventional sense, although he doesn't tend to lean on these particularly dissonant chords that Schoenberg and later composers did. So that, you know, the composers were sort of drifting in this direction, and it was probably inevitable that that sooner or later someone would go all the way into this completely atonal world, which is what Schoenberg did.
But can you explain atonality, which is also called serial music and 12-tone music?
Yeah, well, those are actually two different things. It's a bit confusing. Atonality simply means avoiding the familiar chords, these sweet major and minor triads that had been in use for hundreds of years and still, you know, constitute almost all pop music today, and looking for these new combinations of tones, pretty much the equivalent of moving from representational painting to abstract painting, or the stream of consciousness in literature. Artists in all fields, avoiding the familiar, finding new worlds of expression. 12-tone music is an extension of atonality. It's simply a particular way of organizing the tones. So in a set of 12 chromatic notes, you don't repeat any until you've gone through the series of 12, which actually, strangely enough, you can write a piece that's tonal according to that principle. If you stack the notes in the right order, you can use major and minor triads, and Alban Berg does that in some of his 12-tone pieces, and his violin concerto is very romantic and very beautiful and quite tonal at times, even though it is, quote-unquote, 12-tone.
Well, Schoenberg and then his two followers, Webern and Alban Berg, they all compose within the system.
Yes.
Perhaps we should listen to something from Schoenberg, a little bit from Sechs kleine Klavierstücke. You say that Schoenberg is the only composer of his time to fully adopt atonalities. The others who use the system, as you point out, or other composers, all went back and forth.
Well, Schoenberg was the first to really leap fully into this new world. Berg never went, his student Berg never went all the way. He held on to some lush, romantic sounds all the way through his career. Webern, his other student, may have actually gone a little further and was perhaps even more extreme in his devotion to this idea. Even on this piece, the Schoenberg piece, it is basically atonal, and yet that major third, that one interval that you hear over and over again, does have a sweetness to it and gives you a sense of center as these other tones drift around it. And it's quite a beautiful piece in a sort of otherworldly way.
How did audiences react to that?
They did not react well to to Schoenberg's first atonal pieces. Everyone knows the story of the Rite of Spring and the riot which greeted the premiere.
But actually, that comes after Schoenberg, doesn't it?
There was actually a few weeks before that the Rite of Spring premiere, there was a concert in Vienna, which was actually more serious. You know, the Rite of Spring thing, there were always these scandals in Paris, and the Bohemians would fight against high society, and it didn't really matter what was being played. And in fact, audiences soon enough really fell in love with the Rite of Spring. Whereas in Vienna, there was a concert where the concert had to be stopped, the police were called, fights broke out, there was a lawsuit in the courts afterward. And, you know, for years, decades after that, and I think right through to today, a kind of a break between composer and audience, and a resentment building up in the audience against the humiliation almost of being confronted with something so unfamiliar in a storied concert hall in Vienna where Brahms and Bruckner not that long ago had presented their music.
How did Schoenberg react to the way his work was being viewed?
Schoenberg became more and more resentful himself. He wasn't quite expecting this to happen. I think there was an element in him that was provocative, and he knew that he was going up against people's ideas of the comfortable and the pleasurable. But he, you know, throughout his life, he longed to communicate to people. And, you know, years later, he was living in California, and he still dreamed of one day just breaking through to the big, wide American audience, and he was trying to write a violin concerto, a piano concerto that would become a popular hit, and it never happened, and it mystified him, and he grew very intransigent in his attitude. So it was kind of a breakdown of communication that happened between the composers and the audience.
I understand that he was approached to write the music for a movie, and he said he would do it, but only if he had the final cut. And so they
I mean, there's this great, one of my favorite stories in the book is this meeting between him and Irving Thalberg at Paramount Studios, legendary studio chief. And Thalberg had heard one of Schoenberg's early pieces on the radio, Transfigured Night, very beautiful romantic music. And so he called Schoenberg in and he said, you know, the other day on the radio, I heard your lovely music. And Schoenberg said, I do not write lovely music. And yeah, he ended up, one of the things he asked for, he wanted to have rhythmic control over the actors as they were speaking their lines, and the rise and fall of the pitch would be added to his specifications. So that didn't go over well.
How much of this was the usual thing where there's a dominant style and then the next generation of artists work against it? And there was a dominant style at that time. It was the German compositional style that Wagner exemplified, wasn't
it? Yeah, above all Wagner. I mean, it's hard to imagine now how influential, how overpowering Wagner was, not only in music, but in all artistic media. He was the one. It was like, he was like, you know, Milan Kundera plus Bob Dylan. I mean, he was, you know, so sophisticated on the one hand, but also had enormous popular appeal. So, you know, the question in the early 20th century, what to do about Wagner again and again, and people were reacting in different ways. Schoenberg introduced these new harmonies. Composers in France reached for the music hall, vaudeville, jazz, popular styles, or go all the way back to the Baroque or the Renaissance. You know, in one way or another, we have to get past this romantic mountain of Wagner's music and find a new 20th century contemporary language.
And there's this odd dialogue that occurs between jazz musicians and European composers. The jazz musicians all loved Debussy and Ravel, mm-hmm. and those composers all love the jazz musicians.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the great stories of the book for me. And all through, I'm very interested in how, you know, we think of classical music all the way over in its strange little corner apart from society. Whereas in fact, composers were really in the thick of things politically, culturally, socially, even if they didn't always find mass audiences. So, particularly with pop music, I'm really fascinated by those exchanges and Stravinsky showing up to hear Charlie Parker. And
Charlie Parker loved Varese.
Yes, and Ellington, you know, listening to classical examples and picking up ideas. And especially in the post-war era, there's these great moments in the 50s and 60s where just things are colliding and interacting, and the Beatles are listening to Stockhausen, and Steve Reich is in a composition class with Phil Lesh, who goes on to join the Grateful Dead, and that same mentality is actually very much with us today, more interaction than you might suspect.
You have a story of George Gershwin being nervous to play before Alban Berg, who encourages him by saying, Mr. Gershwin, music is music.
Yes. Yeah, that's the starting point of the book. And it's not always that simple, but yes, music does exist on this kind of continuum, and the borders between genres can get quite hazy when you really look at them microscopically. And someone like Gershwin, what is he? He was a Tin Pan Alley songwriter on the one hand. He was a classical composer on the other, writing opera and piano concertos. And he had this great double identity, and it all seemed fused together in him. Leonard Bernstein, too, and Kurt Weill, these great figures who had one foot in both worlds. And that's a major part of the 20th century story for me. And those figures are just as daring in their way as Schoenberg and Karlheinz Stockhausen and the identifiable avant-garde artists.
Now, why did Rite of Spring go from being a riot causer to really popular in such a short time?
Oh, well, because
were people getting it?
Yeah, they got it. I mean, it's a pretty easy piece to get in a way. It has this infectious rhythm. It has amazing use of syncopation, where he starts up a steady beat and then the accents start landing on all sides of it, and you get this great bounce, this rhythmic bounce, which is really quite similar to what happens in rock and roll many decades later. And there are dissonances. There are also these very infectious little folk tunes, which Stravinsky grabbed from folk song collections and put straight into the score. So it is tuneful behind all of those crunchy dissonant chords.
Now, Stravinsky left Russia so he didn't have to deal with the Soviet Revolution, but we mentioned Strauss accommodated to Hitler. A lot of other composers had to go into exile, and most of them wound up here: Schoenberg, Bartok, Stravinsky, Rachmaninoff. They came here because they didn't want to have to deal with the complications of politics in Europe.
Yeah, well, some of them just had no choice but to leave. I mean, Schoenberg was pretty much thrown out of Germany. He was teaching in Berlin in 1933 and fired from his job because he was Jewish.
Well, he was actually, his family had converted, and he converted back to Judaism, didn't he? He wrote Moses and Aaron as a way of saying, I associate myself with a Jewish tradition.
Absolutely. And very early on, he was sort of detecting the threat of the Nazis well before a number of others did. In 1934, he wrote to his student Webern that Hitler is going to attempt the extermination of all Jews, which was not something that that others had picked up at that point. So very alert to what was going on. And he ended up in California, which is, you know, surreal to contemplate. And yet he had many students there and exercised a fascinating influence on all different aspects of American music.
Well, it is interesting to see what happens to politics with someone like Wagner, who is an anti-Semite and who gets used politically, and then other composers who are forced to adjust because they live in the Soviet Union, for example.
Yeah.
Do we hear the politics in their music, or are they so great that they transcend the political pressure?
Well, the great story here is Shostakovich, a composer of enormous gifts, one of the great geniuses of the 20th century, who expressed himself very freely in the 1920s, and then when Stalin came to power and socialist realism was in force, he had to simplify his style to a great extent. But he had the craft and the imagination still to write music of enormous complexity and power within those narrow strictures. In fact, he may have produced his greatest works within those limitations, and trying to find an accommodation with Stalin and a very strange relationship where he was sometimes exalted very high and then brought down very low, and he never knew what was coming next. And the whole rest of his life lived in a state of fear, because many around him in 1936, 1937, during the terror, disappeared, and he, for some reason, was spared. And he was always haunted by that. So that story is one of the great stories in 20th century music for me. It's a very, very haunting one.
And then there are a whole bunch of composers who avoid the atonal thing, at the same time try to find other ways to be contemporary. Benjamin Britten, Aaron Copland, Steve Reich, John Cage, Ned Roram, and mm-hmm. any number of others, all the minimalists, for example.
Yeah.
So could they have done what they did if the other things hadn't occurred?
That's a great question, and I actually don't think so. I think, you know, the move toward atonality and the extremes of the avant-garde created the need for a reaction in the other direction, and it's all part of this flowing story, and again, the continuum. And one very important thing I wanted to do with this book was to show, you know, a composer like Sibelius, he too is a modern composer, doing very complex and original things in his symphonies, which on first hearing sound late romantic and have this rather plush, familiar surface, but, you know, quite radical in his own way.
And you link him to John Coltrane.
Oh, well, that's a sort of a coincidental resemblance, I think, between the opening of his Fifth Symphony and Love Supreme. The notes or the intervals are actually the same, so it's bom, 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 which, you know, is also Leonard Bernstein's New York, New York. So it's, a few notes can be used in very different contexts.
And in the case of John Coltrane and the minimalists, we see the influence of Asian music, all sorts of other things. We've seen a lot more fusion in recent years, and maybe that's another way to get around the inevitability of an avant-garde moving to a place where there is very little audience.
Right, yeah. I mean, exciting as the avant-garde story is, it does lead eventually to absurd extremes and just a sense that, I mean, these particular set of possibilities have been exhausted. So let's try again. And the minimalists came along and said, let's go back to basics. What can we do with these very simple chords? Can we reinvent them in new ways? And it's especially a West Coast story, a California story, composers all the way back at the beginning of the 20th century absorbing non-Western influences, and those start percolating. And so by the 60s, you have people like Terry Riley and Steve Reich writing works that are based on repeating figures over a drone, you know, so somewhat in the spirit of Indian music, or these kind of layers of rhythm in the spirit of African music, which Steve Reich studied very closely. And that's a great new beginning for this compositional story.
And we're going to go out with something from Steve Reich. My great thanks to you, Alex Ross, who writes about music for The New Yorker and writes about people like Björk as well as Schoenberg. The book, The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.